This is Radio Equal Shop with your host, Alex Smith.
Imagine technology as a system that gathers up days of people's lives, mixes them with nature, physical things and living things, and then channels products towards a minority, in fact, to a dwindling number of the wealthy elite. All the while, the same technology reduces our chances for survival. I think that's how the Swedish author and anthropologist Alf Hörnberg sees it, but only he can say. Let's ask him. Professor Alf Hörnberg, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex.
Now, most of us think of technology as good ideas, more tools to enable an easier or richer life. What's wrong with our wonderful world of cars, dishwashers, and cell phones?
Right. Well, the notion that technology is basically about ingenious ideas is, I think, erroneous. And it goes, you know, a couple of centuries back in time, or rather it's been erroneous for that time. I would argue that up until the Industrial Revolution, it was largely correct. I mean, inventions and technologies were about people who figured out new practical ways of doing things. But beginning with the Industrial Revolution, say in the late 18th century, there was a second set of circumstances that was absolutely crucial for a technology to exist at all. And not only engineering knowledge, but also the social rates of exchange of resources and labor on the world market, what I would call the world system. So differences in prices, for example, raw cotton from the cotton plantations in the U.S. versus the prices of cotton textiles produced in the U.K., these exchange relations were crucial for the very existence of technology. I would put it very drastically by saying, for example, that the steam engine would not have existed without the slave plantations in southeastern United States.
Well, now it seems everyone, from greens to super capitalists, are looking for the next technology that will save us from technology. Are there other options?
Yeah. First of all, I just want to say you're absolutely right. This is one of the most difficult things to sort of deconstruct, this belief in technological progress, because everybody, regardless of ideological color, subscribes to it. Everybody believes that there will be a new technology that will make us sustainable and so on. My fundamental argument is that we should not be looking for new technological solutions. We should be looking at money. We should be looking at the economy as the problem that both generates these unsustainable and inequitable technologies and destroys our environment. We should be thinking in terms of how our ideas on money and the economy can be changed instead.
Well, right. Speaking in Paris a couple of years ago, you suggested only an economic crisis would open doorways for meaningful change at the political level, and it looks like we're entering another crisis now. Does that give you more hope?
Well, I must admit that I felt quite a lot of hope around 2008. There was a lot of talk of a global financial crisis, and I was wondering if this might, in fact, shape a new kind of political discussion, dialogue about the role of the economy in human society and the biosphere and so on. But now, I mean, this year, 2016, 8 years will have passed, and I don't see any major changes, really. So I think it will require more of a crisis, a more fundamental crisis, to make it feasible to talk about these things in a more detached way. I think we're way too comfortable yet, at least in Europe and North America, to really, really start rethinking what modern civilization is all about and technology is all about.
I totally agree with you. But I did notice after the shock of 2008 that a few communities started local currencies, or at least barter dollars. Could an alternative currency actually help reduce carbon emissions?
Yes, I'm quite convinced that that's the way to approach it. But I've been looking at the great number of experiments with alternative currencies that have been conducted over the past 30 or 40 years, actually, the so-called LETS economies, local exchange trading systems, and you have Ithaca hours, you have Bristol pounds, you have a number of different kinds of community currencies, alternative currency schemes, and I do think that they suffer from certain, you know, they have certain problems, and one of them is that they're generally initiated from the grassroots level, which sounds democratic and nice, but which means that they are generally they're sort of antagonistic vis-a-vis the establishment, which generally means that they are marginalized and they survive only as long as a few enthusiasts manage to keep their energy up. I mean, if they rely on local people's enthusiasm, then they're doomed. We need a system that really is backed up by the authorities and that will continue regardless of individual enthusiasm. And I think the other thing that is I would like to see changed in these initiatives is that the currency, I would call it a complementary currency, because it would exist alongside the formal general currency. But this complementary currency needs to specify what kinds of goods and services it can be exchanged for. And to my mind, it would be important to relocalize the economy by saying that this complementary currency can be used only to buy goods and services that have been produced within a certain radius geographically of the point of purchase. It could be 30 kilometers or 50 kilometers. That's not that important. But the important thing is to have this complementary currency distinguishing between locally produced goods and services on the one hand and what is being sold on the globalized market on the other.
Well, I guess it goes without saying if we have local economies, we're not shipping things long distance using fossil fuels, and there's a greater chance we're not abusing someone else's rights by hiring dirt cheap labor. I want to get on to climate change. Do you see that as another big problem for humanity, or is it the ultimate threat to survival?
Oh, absolutely. It is the ultimate threat, and I understand completely that why it engages millions of people all over the world and why we have these enormous conferences. People are seriously worried, and they have every reason to be worried about climate change.
Alf Hornberg, you became more widely known after your 2001 book, The Power of the Machine. This year you will publish another titled Global Magic. I realize I'm about to ask a huge question, but can you give us a couple of examples of the way your thinking has evolved in the last 15 years?
Yeah, one of the examples I would give has to do with the distinction that I have often been asked to make between magic and technology. And I've found it analytically challenging and difficult to pin down exactly what I mean about machine fetishism, which is a concept that implies that technology is really a version, a modern version of magic. And actually, just last year, I came up with a very concrete example to illustrate what I'm saying. And my point of departure is to compare coins and keys. Now, coins and keys are little pieces of metal. And according to what is known as actor network theory, and people who theorize about how objects and artifacts are given agency, how they actually intervene in social processes, humans delegate agency to things, to artifacts, to the things they make. And this is true for both coins and keys, I would argue. We delegate, we let the coins and the keys act, so to speak. They have social impacts. But there's a crucial difference between coins and keys, and this is what I really would like to emphasize. The agency of coins is contingent on what humans believe about them, about their subjective ideas. Money would not have any agency if we did not believe that money was valuable, whereas keys have agency. They turn a lock simply because of the way they're physically designed, not because of what humans believe about them. And I would argue that this simple distinction is what distinguishes magic from technology. And I would argue, actually, as a corollary, that very much of modern technology somewhere along the line is contingent on human beliefs. So I would argue in that sense, it is a version of magic.
We talked about money, but the real underpinnings of our financial system seem to remain off limits and mysterious. I mean, scientists are allowed to study natural systems in tremendous detail, how sea creatures reproduce and so on. But who really owns what is a secret matter for private banks and private corporations, even if they threaten to ruin the natural world. Can you comment on that?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I agree with your understanding of finance completely. And I do think that finance is actually the point where magic enters the picture. I think after 2008 and the financial crisis, most of us have become aware of the fact that there's a kind of a magic about money. I mean, for us here in Europe, it's pretty amazing to hear that the U.S. in just the last couple of years or so has become a major exporter of fossil fuels again. And you wonder how is this possible? You know, we thought, speaking of net energy and so on, we thought that U.S. had to go to war in the Middle East to secure its oil imports, and here we're hearing no, the U.S. can fix its own oil at this point. And the more we think about it, of course, we realize that this would be impossible without finance, that it's actually what goes on Wall Street and other contexts like that that makes it possible to pump oil out of the U.S. and run technology on it. So finance, the magic of money, is actually making American oil an active material component in the economy. Finance underwrites the agency, the material agency of oil. And that goes to show how magic actually intervenes, impinges, and becomes fundamental to technology.
But if we stop believing that, we're told, if we try and change the rules of the game, it's all going to fall apart and we'll all starve in the dark in our cities. How do we manage to rationalize and become so blind to these things?
Yeah, I think we have a lot to learn about how human perceptions and worldviews actually intervene in very tangible ways in the way we organize global society, technologically, economically. We can no longer believe that the physical world, the material world, and the world of human ideas are two separate parts of reality because they do intermingle. And what we have to do is to understand how this occurs, and we have to maintain, I think, importantly, an analytical distinction between the pre-human world, thermodynamics, gravity, the material world that we used to call nature on one hand, and all the kinds of social conventions and symbolic systems and ideas and so on that we develop in human societies. We have to maintain an analytical distinction to be able to say this is nature and this is society. But then, of course, we know that the nature and society are all the time intermingled in our bodies, in our landscapes, our technologies. They're always mixed up. But we should know what comes from nature and what comes from society. I think we shouldn't let go of that distinction.
Radio EcoShock.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest, the Swedish author and anthropologist from Lund University, Alf Hernberg. Alf, picking up on what you just said, I interviewed the popular German journalist Christian Schwagerl about his book, The Anthropocene, The Human Era and How It Shapes Our Planet. What dangers lurk in proclaiming this to be the new human age?
Yeah, a colleague and I actually published a little piece on this in the Anthropocene Review of the journal a couple of years ago, and it's been quite widely cited. The argument that we have advanced in that paper is that if we call this the age of humans, we're implying that it's humanity, an undifferentiated human species, that has created all the problems we have in the Anthropocene, climate change, and so on. Whereas my colleague and I would argue that it's historically a minority of the human species who have kind of propelled these changes by inaugurating the Industrial Revolution and consequently the Anthropocene. So we would prefer other denominations. I would personally prefer the technocene. I know my colleague Andreas Malm coined the concept capitalocene and so on. There are other words that would make it more clear that this is not humanity as a whole that has developed this new era. It's a small privileged elite who have actually driven these changes.
Okay, we started talking about technology, and people grudgingly admit money could be a root of evil, but certainly not technology. Are you suggesting we can unplug and walk away from the technomass we have created, and wouldn't billions of people die in short order if we did that?
I think very much would emerge sort of automatically out of a fundamental change of the economy. And I'm not at all convinced that sort of getting off the technology, so to speak, would put a lot of people in peril. In fact, I would argue the opposite. It would liberate people to start using the land and their labor time for more sustainable things than we're doing now. Actually, there is enough soil and other resources on this planet to support the population we have now without fossil fuels. In fact, if you want to be really drastic, another colleague of mine figured out that if everybody was a vegan, now of course we're not all vegans, but if all humans were vegans, there would be room for about 30 billion of us on this planet without cutting down one more tree and without fossil fuels. So really, I think that this myth that, you know, we have to have fossil fuels and modern technology in order to feed two of the world's 7-8 billion people, I think is a myth, definitely.
Okay. Another justification is the idea that the geographical locus of this collection machine, as you might call it, has an ability to shift over time. We think of the rise of Japan, Korea, and now China as centers of not just technology, but the accumulation of capital. The wealth might appear anywhere, we say. Or does technology always need that hinterland of slums and poverty somewhere else to function?
I think it does. I've published a few texts where I use the notion of the zero-sum world or a zero-sum game. I do think that technology is very much about saving time and space by some people at the expense of time and space lost by other people, so that what we think of as technological progress or growth or capital accumulation is really about developing capacities to liberate and save time and space, human time and natural space, in some sectors of the world system at the expense of other sectors where human time and natural space are lost and are in fact used to subsidize those gains that some of us with enough purchasing power make.
Alf Hornberg, what does economic anthropology tell us about climate change and our prospects of avoiding a climate catastrophe?
I'm not sure that economic anthropology in itself directly would respond to that, but there are perspectives from economic anthropology that I think could be applied. For example, our almost universal human concern with reciprocity. The classic, of course, is Marcel Mauss' book, The Gift, where he draws on a Maori informant who early in the 20th century says that if you you receive a gift, you have to repay it somehow. And I think this can actually be applied to climate change. There's a lot of talk now about climate justice, and we know that portions of world population have been using much too large parts of the atmosphere as sinks for carbon dioxide at the expense of other populations who are suffering from more floods and droughts and so on than others. There's a kind of a reciprocity problem about climate and climate justice.
Yeah, so I guess it's a crass question, but all of us are asking ourselves inside, what would climate justice cost us, the average person in America or Scandinavia? What do we have to give up in order to get that?
Yeah, I wish I was good at remembering figures, but let's just put it this way, that in order for these changes to really materialize that people talked about in Paris when everybody was cheering about how we're now entering the post-fossil age and so on, if those changes would really materialize, it would require very, very much and a very, very radical change of lifestyle for most of us. I know that, for example, in Sweden, carbon dioxide emissions, not only from what we produce in Sweden, but if we include also the stuff we consume that has been produced, much of it in China, we have about emissions of about 12 tons of carbon per year per capita, which is about twice the formal statistics that say, like, okay, Sweden has about 5 or 6 tons per capita, but that's just production-based. And if we want to get down to, say, around 1 ton per capita, you can imagine that it would mean reducing our consumption levels to about 1/12 of where we are now. And we're talking that scale. So it's a major change for Europeans and Americans.
Yeah, personally, I think one idea is to get rid of the idea of new, that we have to buy everything new. There's already so many products in the world, too many cars already, all of that. I think we just have to start using used things. That's one answer. Well, you know, the cynic would say that words like justice and morality or ethics don't matter to enough people to change our course, but I have noticed a series of older people like you, myself, and James Hansen seem motivated partly by fear for our grandchildren's future. As an anthropologist, is that a viable driver for human action?
Yeah, it's a good question. As you say, I have grandchildren myself, and it makes me think a lot more about what this planet will look like 70 or 80 years from now. I think the concept of morality is very important in these discussions, in particular because modern neoclassical or neoliberal economics has a very special relation to morality that I think is problematic. I've often tried to test the concept of unequal exchange on economists, and they say, well, we never heard of it, really. We don't use that word. And I think the whole notion of unequal exchange, which is a moral concept, basically, the fact that it's not, doesn't sort of ring a bell for economists, it tells you that morality is not their main point, you know, it's not their main issue. Their main issue is the mechanisms that determine prices on the world market. But what is actually being exchanged on the world market in terms of energy, matter, embodied labor, and so on, land, embodied land, is not as important as whether those price mechanisms operate the way they should, according to economists. So morality is a major issue, but to get back to your question, whether it's enough to really make us change our behavior, I cannot answer, and I certainly don't want to suggest that I personally am doing all that much for the world, except, you know, writing my books and getting engaged in the debates. I do think we need major decisions, structural decisions about the economy that need to be taken democratically in parliaments. I don't think we should be hoisting the burden onto individuals because we feel bad about the world as it is, and we have so little power as individuals So I don't think it's really correct to let us carry the burden of guilt as well for what's happening.
Well, some people say we've been brainwashed by a powerful elite. There are mega corporations and the media are owned by just a few corporations, but that sort of lets us off the hook. And I wonder if it's true. I mean, is it the rest of us? When politicians say, well, look, I don't have the political support to make these changes. People want what they want. How can we answer that?
Well, so far we're just too comfortable in Europe and North America to really make drastic changes in our lives. But I do believe that crises of one kind or another, and perhaps in particular financial crisis, could quickly change our readiness to change. So I think we may need some kind of push from the economy to really change our behavior. And people are apparently very versatile. I mean, we only need to recall in the 1930s, which was the last major economic depression. And as far as I understand, I wasn't around then, but as far as I understand, people very readily, you know, plowed up their lawns and planted potatoes and changed their lifestyle very quickly as an adjustment to the economic changes that they were experiencing. And I think that that's what we can probably hope for in the future as well.
Well, our time together has been too short. We can't possibly capture your long career of powerful ideas. Alf Hernberg has been one of the more difficult and rewarding guests that I have researched. You can find links to learn more yourself in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. We reached Alf at the prestigious Lund University in Sweden, where he has been a professor of human ecology since 1993. Thank you so much for sharing your time and ideas with us.
Thank you, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.